Jacqueline made quick mention of OCAP. So, you know, participants are reviewing the transcripts in the coming weeks. And so at each step of the journey, everything, in as much as a project can do, is in the hands of survivors. And so having that, working with an organization who is nodding their head saying, okay, we will do things in these ways, no problem at all. And then being fluid. So that idea that sometimes you show up to open the relationship and really with no expectations, but every now and again someone's like, yeah, let's sit down and do it right now. And we're like, oh, okay. Or sometimes that's in a circle, right? That's a part of going into a community meeting. And so again, in all the good ways that we were guided to come to know everybody involved in the project, this project wouldn't be what it was without that leadership and community. And, I know we're all very humbled by that, and we have so, so much gratitude for those relational practices.
Yeah, I think that's so beautiful, and how you all speak to how you this project has become such a interconnected piece, where you've managed to be in connection and in partnership with Indigenous groups all over Canada and getting their involvement in it. And that whole process is exactly what, from what I've learned over here, of what truth and like reconciliation is meant to be looking like. And it's not this stuffy institutionalized idea. It's all about community and listening to each other and helping each other. And with this research that you're doing, obviously you started it in 2023, and I'm not sure if it's finishing in 2026 or you're going to release the results in 2026. But I was wondering I know we spoke about you lot wanting to talk of the evolution of this research and getting into this research area. Obviously, with She Matters and Jacqueline, you had the Silence Report in 2021 that kind of started to address an accessibility issue with sexual assault evidence kits. So how has that all kind of evolved into what you're doing now?
Following the release of the Silenced Report, we were able to connect with hundreds of survivors across the country, and care providers and family members and relatives of those who had experienced inaccessibility. And so that really shed a light on the need for more. And so when this opportunity presented itself through a community-based research grant funded by the Ministry of Women and Gender Equity, Chloe and I spoke and shared that we would like to put forward an application. And then things really started to flow together beautifully from there. We actually had connected with the Yukon Aboriginal Women's Council through the Silenced Report. Their ED at the time had reached out and shared their interest in collaborating in the future. So when this opportunity presented itself, I reached out to their executive director again and shared that we would love to work together on this project if there would be interest. And we are very grateful to hear that they were interested in partnership in this work. And being that our organization was rooted in Northern Ontario, we knew that would be a region that we wanted to explore as well. Chloe, living within British Columbia and having a lot of connections in that area, we felt that would be another province that would be very aligned for this work specifically. So that's how everything kind of flowed together from in terms of the regions that were represented in this work. In regards to the research itself, again, just allowing the space for storytelling to really take the forefront in this work, and being very mindful that the data itself was represented in the silenced report, but the voices of those impacted were not heard in that research. And so we wanted that to really be the focal point of this work and to allow for the public who showed through both a change.org petition and reaching out after the release of the silenced report, showing that there was interest in advocating for the need for additional accessibility, but also being understanding of how the general public reacts to research and wanting to develop something that would really connect with people's hearts and allowing themselves to almost be seen in the issue itself and seen in the overall experiences that survivors and care providers shared within the work. And so anyone's free to jump in at any time, but I feel that how the research kind of came together, and even a part of the work itself is that we will also have a podcast series which actually shares the voices of the participants who wanted to share within that element of the knowledge sharing from this research itself, coinciding with our report, and that will be released in the coming months. And then you brought up the timeline. So we're wrapping things up in terms of our knowledge sharing activities in March of 2026. But over the coming months, we'll be releasing our report and engaging folks in advocacy-based initiatives that coincide with the findings of the report itself, and allowing for people to connect with those who participated in the research through both the report itself and the podcast too. I don't know if Patty, you want to jump in here and share as well.
The other thing that started to, I would say we are starting to get a little momentum with is through the relationship at the university, we had the opportunity to present to the Canadian Pain Society. There is a really high correlation between sexual assault and the onset of chronic pain later in life. And we know that that's a really big deal. And so we were able to, you know, kind of, I would say walk out the preliminary results. Those stories, if you will, that discuss the root causes of what is going on in terms of obstacles for survivors, the gifts that those survivors carry and how they navigate the system currently, but alongside both community and survivors' desire to have community-first models, to have personal models, to be able to navigate the systems. And then in particular, although this applies to both Indigenous and non-Indigenous survivors, to change everything from the clinical suite, and that Indigenous folks can call their own medicine. So this is where the development of health technologies is starting. You know, we're starting to have ideas around that. So can I literally, while I am going through this process, call for a matriarch from my community, call for song, call for the drums, call the land into the clinical suite? And so can we redesign clinical suites in that particular way? But what we know today is that the first responses matter so much to survivors. We know that there is the collection of forensic DNA has almost swung too far to the technical, and we have really lost the humanity and the care in the pathway, and that needs a correction itself. And survivors know what they need, and so we need to be listening, health authorities, governments, and communities. You know, there are really tangible things we have learned for folks to act on.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. And I think the what you mentioned, Jacqueline, of your first report having such a data focus, but not a focus on the survivors' voices and stories, and that being a shift that you've done for the research this way, is because I think too often when data is collected in this sector of sexual violence and things like that, it's too focused on just quantitative numbers, and you forget about the people behind those numbers and the stories that are there. And like Patty said, survivors know what they need. They know exactly what they want to do and get out of it. And it's we have to be listening to them and understanding it because it's not happening, and you're seeing it in so many different avenues. I mean, I've done several discussions this past 2 week to talk about how the criminal justice system, specifically in England and Wales, but also just globally, doesn't listen to survivors in what they want and how they can get justice. It's not listening to them at all.
I want to add, not only are these systems not listening, they are loading on more complex trauma. So whether that is medical trauma, which is I am treated a particular way as I come through those doors at emergency because of who I am, because I'm a woman, because I'm Indigenous or a racialized person, that adds trauma. Intergenerational trauma for Indigenous folks, racism, and being pathologized. All of those traumas exacerbate the assault incident. And that is so incredibly important. This is what the survivors have raised in terms of those root causes. And I am excited that we can say these things in terms of reframing a standard of practice that addresses all of that with full knowledge. And this is the real gift, and again, moment of feeling so humble that 62 survivors, rights holders, care providers, and a handful of law enforcement have shared their stories with us on this particular project.
Yeah, absolutely. I also, with you saying that you're releasing the results in the coming months, on wanted to ask on what each of you found to be the most difficult part of this research project.
I think for myself, it connects with a point that Patty just made that throughout this research, we've really seen that survivors know what we need. And I think the majority of the institutions are very aware that we know what we need. And there is, from an institutional standpoint, a system that is created to not acknowledge survivors' voices, not acknowledge the trauma that we have experienced, and not put forward a pathway that really allows for you to feel like you're making the right decision when you are seeking care. From a systemic standpoint, it's encouraged to seek care, seek support, collect evidence, report your experience. But from all of the conversations that we had and throughout this work, I continued to hear that every person we spoke to was doing all the right things to protect themselves, to keep themselves safe. And that system itself really is just not created for us, despite it existing to support those who are currently going through the most difficult experience that they will likely have to endure. So I, from my personal perspective, that knowing that and seeing it represented over and over and over was one of the most challenging elements of this work.
Yeah, I mean, I myself don't identify as a survivor, but I hear what Jacqueline is saying and agree, like, on the piece with people who are doing everything that they're told to do to protect themselves and support themselves, and seeing even the perseverance in some situations. And these are conversations had not just in this research, but also in general conversations in the work we do. We hear these stories of perseverance through situations, and when folks are making it to that spot where they're supposed to receive support and the support is not there, or they're met with racism, that obviously is extremely challenging to hear, because it's one thing to, in this work, you can kind of compartmentalize things, right? You think of it in an abstract manner, but then when you're hearing stories from survivors, it's a double-edged sword, because you see the pain and the hurt and what they've gone through, but you also see their immense strength. And seeing survivors come out on the other end from one of the most horrific nights of their lives and maybe hopefully start to recognize their strength and their survivance is definitely inspiring. But just hearing those stories are definitely, it's definitely harrowing.
Yeah, and I'd say for my part, in terms of the system's response, it's really challenging to hear across three different geographies and from multiple survivors that trained medical professionals and procedures, processes, clinical suites that are devoted for the collection of forensic DNA are not trauma-informed, let alone trauma-wise. And so we are building trauma on trauma, given those circumstances. And it gets really, really dicey. The most difficult theme, if you will, from this research is folks showing up, folks driving 3 hours from a remote community into a hub city to be told no one's in to do the exam. Please come back. Yeah. It's unacceptable.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah. I think as well, like, applying it to what I know about the justice system for survivors in England and Wales, less on the accessibility crisis of these kids and being turned away, but just that the whole process of your identity and who you are being completely stripped and torn apart when you're just trying to seek healing and justice for something that you would never have wanted to have gone through, yet had to go through as something. And again, spoken quite a bit about it with different people on how the criminal justice system is a process that, like you said, is designed to help you and to protect you and to give you what you need, and it isn't designed to do that. Well, that's the purpose of it, and it's designed completely wrong, from like reporting to a trial process that's a process that just re-traumatizes a survivor at each stage. And then one thing that I've been researching a bit more is just kind of how they're at the end of it, if they got a conviction or not, and then just dropped and just left. And then they're just left to deal with the fact that they were traumatized from the event and then re-traumatized the whole time in trying to deal with the aftermath of it, and then have just been put on their own to deal with it. So it's clearly a common theme globally and is experienced in different ways depending on where. And obviously with your research here in Canada, looking specifically at remote and rural communities, that is clearly affecting Indigenous women and girls a lot more. How would you say that we can better support Indigenous survivors in these rural areas when it comes to evidence collection and access to justice?
If I could just jump in, I would say, so in Northern BC and the Yukon, there are no forensic nurse examiners practicing. That is because of the policies of those places. And so the exams are currently conducted by doctors. Yukon has a pretty great system, I would say, or good system in Whitehorse. with the kind of the doctors that are stepping forward to do the exams. However, the rest of the Yukon is very much lacking in that system. One thing I would say is having specially trained trauma-wise forensic nurse examiners in those areas and having Indigenous forensic nurse examiners would be a step forward. Reporting to the hospital and having an exam conducted by a medical professional is definitely not for everyone. So I'm not saying that's the be-all, end-all. However, I do think if there were forensic nurses who are specially trained to work with Indigenous populations, that would be a way to move forward for some survivors.
I also think too, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Chloe and Patty, of the waiting suite in, was it Watson Lake in the Yukon, and how culturally sensitive and welcoming and inviting that space was. And I'll speak to the perspective of myself being a survivor who did not report as a measure to keep myself safe. And I'm sharing that because one thing we did throughout the research in the interviews led by Patty was that we really tried to honor survivors' gifts. And in that, you're recognizing the things that you did to protect yourself. So for anyone who is listening to this interview, who is a survivor, I'm recognizing what I had to do to keep myself safe in how I'm sharing. But when I think to some of those barriers for myself personally, knowing that I would have to wait and knowing that being away for that time frame could lead to so many issues for myself, I think that is a very common situation for many survivors. Patty brought forward the issue of survivors having to travel very far distances to access sexual assault evidence kits. For those who do travel and get to a community that does have kits available, in most cases, you are still there waiting for several hours. Even though procedurally, if you look on websites for many northern and remote hospitals who do have specialized care, so they claim typically the wait time, it will say that you, and this is triage procedure as well, would be 30 minutes and then you'll be seen. In reality, sometimes that 30 minutes is 10 hours. Come back in 24 hours. Just that in itself is not realistic for survivors, and especially for survivors who are Indigenous, who already do not trust our healthcare systems, and rightfully so, who will experience stigma just waiting in a common waiting area. And so I really think back to the system that was created in Watson Lake in having a very inviting, private waiting area. And I really think that needs to be integrated into the standard of care at every hospital and health center throughout the country. I think every hospital and health center needs to have a room in place for both sexual assault and domestic violence in order to support survivors of sexual violence and domestic abuse. And as we know, statistically, that is disproportionately affecting Indigenous people across our country. So I think foundationally, that is what one of my biggest kind of takeaways would be in order to best support Indigenous survivors. But as other Indigenous organizations and advocates have already been sort of leading the way and advocating in terms of advancements in healthcare, we need to have culturally appropriate supports available to survivors who are Indigenous at every hospital and health center. Full stop. And there are other folks who are already leading the way and advocating for those protections in our healthcare settings. And that's something that we just really want to amplify, those voices who are already leading in those areas. That needs to be integrated into our systems. You can't feel safe in a healthcare setting if you don't see yourself represented. And especially as it relates to sexualized violence, you need to know that you're in an environment where you'll be seen and heard and supported, and you need to be supported regardless of how you present at the hospital as well. I think that's a very key factor that care providers need to be aware of when it comes to supporting Indigenous survivors. You need to support anyone who presents for care and ensure that you are delivering the same standard of care to all survivors.
And I would just add briefly, it goes without saying that Indigenous women and matriarchs have taken care of other women who have been hurt since time immemorial. And so, She Matters in this project can amplify, we can add this to the other stellar work that is occurring in Indigenous community. But that matriarchy and what those processes look at, distinct from community to community to community, need to very much be a part of the work going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we are kind of running a bit low on time, and to wrap this up, which I'd like to just thank each and every one of you for taking the time. I know it was quite hectic to schedule, but to take the time to talk to me today and to help me put this issue out there. I've enjoyed listening to it, even though it's not an enjoyable topic. I've enjoyed listening to it and learning about each of your work. But to kind of finish up with the research that you have done, this project that you're working on, what is it that you're hoping to achieve with the results?
As we are wrapping the project, one common sort of theme stands out to me, and that is advancing the care pathways that are available to survivors across Canada or Turtle Island. And so for myself and for our organization, I would say that is what we are hoping to achieve. We are hoping that this research will really serve as a tool to advocate for care pathways to be advanced, for accessibility to be available to every survivor, regardless of where they reside, to be able to walk into any hospital and health center and receive trauma-wise care, feel seen, feel heard, be provided with a referral to support services. And that is ultimately what I really hope for this work to be able to achieve.
That is summing it up perfectly. Thank you so much, Chloe, Jacqueline, and Patty, for being a part of this discussion with me and explaining the significance of the research and the issues that you are addressing. And welcome back to Intravenous here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, where we have just heard my discussion with Chloe Hunt, Jacqueline Villeneuve Ahmed, and Patty Derbyshire in regard to their research of access to evidence collection kits in rural and remote communities here in Canada. I want to thank them again for being able to take part in that discussion with me. I'm extremely grateful, and I really enjoyed it, and I hope you enjoyed listening to it. We are coming up to the top of the hour, where Democracy Now! Will be taking over at 11 a.m. And this is my last Intravenous episode, so I just want to put a thank you out there to everyone listening to me talk about all the different gender topics that interest me and that I thought would interest you for my time here at CJSF. I also want to thank Robin for bringing me onto the show. I will be forever grateful that I got to not only co-host with Robin, but also take over Intravenous after she left. And I hope I did it justice whilst we're talking about the topic of justice. And I want to thank everyone at CJSF as well. I've really enjoyed volunteering here, and it's been a great experience, and I'm really going to miss it. So yeah, a big thank you to you listening, and a big thank you to everyone here. And yeah, I hope you have a good rest of your day and week, and stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up next.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.